Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Yeah, so Greece. I mean, what else is there to say? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you with us on this Thursday, everybody. It's the 3rd of November today, and I don't know if you remember this, but we started the show the other day by pointing out how there's never a dull moment in the Greek debt crisis. Yeah, if I'd have been smart, I'd have saved that line, because the twos and fros today have been positively dizzying. At the moment, here's where it stands. George Papandreou is still the prime minister of Greece, but probably only until a confidence vote tomorrow. The much-criticized referendum on whether to take the bailout has been taken off the table. As for where things go from here, though, that's anybody's guess, because for the first time, the two core members of the Eurozone, Germany and France, have started to think the previously unthinkable. And what's more, they've been thinking aloud, spelling out the possibility that if Greece doesn't knuckle down or knuckle under, take your pick, to another dose of austerity, it may have to leave the Eurozone, like it or not. So how might that go? We asked our man in London, Stephen Beard, to figure it out.
This is impossible. It cannot happen. Under the treaty that created the euro, member countries can neither pull out nor be ejected from the single currency. Tim Loinig of the London School of Economics.
There's absolutely no blueprint. In fact, it's agreed that it will never happen. But sometimes things that will never happen do happen.
And if it does, it'll happen fast. It'll have to. Greece's next currency will plummet like a stone against the euro. Economist Andrew Hilton says, unless the government in Athens quickly slaps on capital controls, Greek banks would empty overnight.
Any sentient Greek will pull whatever money he or she has out of the bank accounts in Greece and put them into bank accounts in Germany or elsewhere in the Eurozone.
Greece wouldn't necessarily have to print billions of new banknotes, says Gabriel Stein of Lombard Street Research.
Euro banknotes have a national letter in the serial number, so initially the Greek euro, renamed the drachma, will be using the Greek euro notes.
However, he concedes this could trigger a huge cross-border fraud.
People from other euro countries load a suitcase full of good euros, go to Greece, buy cheap euros from the Greeks, and then come back and use them in their own cash machines.
If Greece does quit the euro, it'll be able to devalue its new currency, promote growth, break free from stagnation and austerity. But Julian Pendock of Senhouse Capital says there could be a downside. Hyperinflation, and who knows what else.
Whatever happens, one can be sure that there'll be a lot of laws of unintended consequences kicking in.
No one knows what, because no one's been blown out of the Eurozone before. Perhaps it's just as well it cannot happen. Can it? In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
No matter how big the company, $3 billion is still a whole lot of money, which gets us to the British drug conglomerate GlaxoSmithKline today. Glaxo's going to pay $3 billion to settle a bunch of long-standing criminal and civil cases brought by the U.S. government. Included in the bill of particulars are allegations that Glaxo convinced doctors to prescribe its drugs for uses not approved by the FDA. That's a big no-no. It's called off-label marketing. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Gregory Warner has the story.
A drug approved for blood pressure might be really good at preventing kidney damage. And if your doctor prescribes it that way, it's called off-label. That happens a lot, one in every five prescriptions.
Insurers typically pay for the use, off-label use, but drug companies are not allowed to promote it for that purposes.
Gail Walensky is the former head of Medicaid. She now runs the nonprofit Project Hope. She says the government has always allowed doctors the freedom to prescribe as they see fit, but it does not extend that same freedom to what sales reps can say about a drug. The government has collected billions of dollars from drug firms for allegedly violating this ban, firms including Pfizer, Eli Lilly, and now GlaxoSmithKline. Those same companies are challenging that ban in court. They say the sales rep spiel is a form of free speech and should be protected.
Companies might be able to say virtually anything about it. Their product exercises a health effect, a sanity effect, a happiness effect.
Dan Carpenter is a professor of government at Harvard who studies the FDA. He says the Supreme Court recently wrote a decision that some drug marketing is free speech protected. A case now in the Federal Court of Appeals could decide whether that protection extends to off-label marketing. It's a question worth tens of billions of dollars.
If these rules were overturned, it would mean huge revenue increases for these pharmaceutical companies.
And a smaller role for the Food and Drug Administration. He says it would limit the FDA to just approving drugs, not saying what diseases they've been proven to treat. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
There's a line to be had here in setting up this next story about nobody taking my Kodachrome away, but it escapes me at the moment. Kodak, the pioneering photography company, missed earnings estimates by a mile today and warned investors it could have trouble staying in business if things don't go its way. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
The year was 1900. The product was Kodak's Brownie camera. For just a dollar, it brought photography to the masses. Kodak made a fortune, not selling cameras, but by selling film. Then in the 70s, when Kodak still dominated this market, its scientists invented digital photography.
It just turned the business inside out. It was a destructive technology.
Especially for Kodak. Mark Kaufman's at Rafferty Capital. He says when cameras no longer needed film, Kodak's core business collapsed. Ed Lee follows the industry at InfoTrends.
Come the end of the decade, that there'll be very, very little film being used.
So Kaufman says one of Kodak's most valuable assets are the patents on the digital technology it created.
Between 2008 and 2010, they took in $1.5 billion in patent revenue.
And executives hope by selling rights to that technology, they'll keep the company afloat as it tries to build a new business in digital printing. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I don't know, I guess traders like the certainty of continued Greek uncertainty. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All righty, everybody, step right up and place your bets on the Great American Unemployment Roulette Wheel, because by this time tomorrow, we are going to know how many jobs the American economy added or, in the interests of defining the odds for you a little bit better, perhaps lost last month. We can tell you now, though, the number of jobs added will be at least one. It belongs to 29-year-old Sandra Morin, who, after being out of work for a year, started a new job this Monday at the Chicago Office of Tourism and Culture. We know that because we've been keeping up with her since September when we asked her what it was like not having a job.
One of the things that I have noticed is that when I do apply to jobs, often I'm applying to jobs that I am overqualified for, which may be one of the reasons I am not getting them. Another reason, I believe, is the fact that I've been unemployed for so long. And so my resume reads, the last time I had a job was September 2010.
Sandra, it's good to talk to you.
Likewise, thank you.
So what's it like to hear that tape again?
It's kind of bittersweet.
Yeah. What was that point in your life like? I mean, you'd been out of work by that point when you talked to us for almost a year, right?
Yeah. And I was kind of on a pretty intense job hunt at that point. I was submitting resumes out almost every day. And sometimes I would take a break and breathe. But even those breaks would be, you know, you worry.
That's a great line. Take a break and breathe, you know?
It's important.
Yeah. You had unemployment insurance, I imagine, right, during that time?
I did, yes.
And how much more did you have left?
Until December.
December as in next month, right?
Yeah, December 2011.
And then what? What would have happened?
I was working a part-time job. So, you know, I was also looking at coffee shop jobs.
Did you ever, when you got out of school, imagine you'd be 29 and looking for coffee shop jobs?
No. I think I imagined I would honestly be on a PhD track.
In what?
Literature, writing.
Tell me about your new job.
I started this Monday. My supervisor is amazing. My department is amazing.
Which is great, right? I mean, it's very cool that you found a job you like, let alone found a job.
Yes. And that was the pull for me is, you know, this position opened up and, you know, I was qualified for it. And it was in an area, you know, tourism and leisure. Within that lies like arts and culture.
Sure.
And that's right up my alley. It's great.
have you sat through the obligatory, you know, HR orientation stuff and all that stuff? You
yes,
do?
Indeed.
And it was probably great, right? It was
wonderful.
It was nice. Yeah, there, that's
yeah,
right. There
it was
you
like,
go.
Oh,
oh no, I have to go to orientation. Yay, it's great. Tell me about your peers and your friends. I mean, I imagine you were not the only one in the group that was looking for work.
No. Funny, a good friend of mine, the same day that I was laid off at my last job, I had sent him an email that day and said, oh, my goodness, I just got laid off. Yeah. And he responded, me too.
Oh.
And we ran into each other once at the unemployment office, and that was just kind of eye-rolling and bizarre.
Oh, no, I bet. Now, tell me about him. Does he have a job yet?
He does.
All right, so maybe I'm reading too much into the two stories that you're telling me here, yours and his, but is there a sense of optimism, perhaps?
I do think so. And I think the optimism lies, though, in a sense of thinking realistically and not getting depressed in your sort of unemployment phase and really looking at what your strengths are and putting 110% effort in your resume and in your cover letters.
This is sort of a necessarily negative question. How did you not just pull the covers over your head every single day and just stay in bed and sit on the couch, right? I mean, how do you keep going?
Some days I did, especially in Chicago, February.
yeah.
And it definitely got easier within, you know, the first few months. It was kind of hard hitting. But then after that, you have to lift yourself up out of that place.
How'd you do it?
I started volunteering, actually, for a few organizations in Chicago. I started investing a lot of time and energy in volunteering and helping out.
Yeah, and it lets you not just stay energized, but I imagine you keep, you know, your people skills and your organizational skills and all that stuff up, right?
Yes, yeah, and you feel valued.
Sandra Morin, we'd talk more, but hey, you know what? She's got to go back to work.
I know.
Sandra, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Bill Rogers is a labor economist at the Blaustein School of Planning and Public Policy at Rutgers University. Bill, good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
Let's pick up on that last point from Sandra, if we could, and talk about nonprofits and their potential to help create jobs in this economy, because Lord knows not a whole lot else is working.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that distinguishes nonprofits, particularly in the social services world, is that unlike the private sector, which has seen very little job creation, only a little more than 2 million since February 2010, nonprofits have seen a dramatic increase in the growth for their services, whether it be food pantries or whether it be, you know, adult daycare. But conversely, or problematic, is that we've seen a major drop in those resources. So what folks talk about doing is, one, either getting people out to volunteer, such as Sandra, because, as she said, yeah, it's a way to keep her skills sharp. It's a way to also keep that resume from getting gaps on it. But also, you're providing those services and you're stepping out of yourself.
Yeah. How do you do it, though? I mean, it's not like there's all kinds of money to go around to create all kinds of new jobs, right? Do you have to make a choice between, say, infrastructure and nonprofits?
I would probably keep the infrastructure on the books, and I would probably say it's a choice between some of the tax cuts that have been levied or, you know, been offered to particularly those at the upper part of the income scale, and utilizing some of those dollars and providing wage subsidies to nonprofits who are willing to hire for a short-term period. I'm viewing these nonprofit opportunities as kind of that bridge to our next prosperity until we start to see job creation in the 200 to 300,000 range. And why do I feel that way? Well, one is, so we've seen a major drop in our ability to meet the growing needs. And so I'm not talking about people coming in and working in the food pantry and actually handing out food. You could do that. We need people who can help with resource development, who can help with strategic planning, who can help with improving our accounting standards. And, you know, of those who are unemployed, you know, there's a great deal of untapped potential.
It is, in essence, countercyclical, right? It's when times are bad, we need those nonprofits more. And then when we have, as you say, that new prosperity, in theory, and hopefully we need them less.
Yes. And, you know, what we've seen is, you know, that a lot of communities still have that 9% unemployment rate, still have that 10% unemployment rate. And that tsunami of need actually hasn't hit the shore yet. So you really, really, we have an opportunity. It's a think big, to think out of the box.
Which in theory is, you know, a net social good, right? Because we all need
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. As I like to say when I talk about this, this is really checks off a lot of boxes.
Bill Rogers at Rutgers University. Professor, thanks a lot for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Coming up in Syria, big business, but big risk.
If there is any strikes or serious opposition on the part of the business community, they could paralyze the economy.
But first, let's do the numbers. Investors breathed just a tad easier after Greece abandoned that vote on a European bailout. The Dow Industrials climbed 208 points, 1.75%, ended at 12,044. The Nasdaq up 57 points, 2.2%, 2697. At the bell, the S&P 500 advanced 23 points, 1.8%, closed at 1261. An unexpected interest rate cut by the European Central Bank before trading opened in New York today also helped perk things up a bit. Estee Lauder splashed on nearly 18% first quarter results for the beauty products maker, beat estimates, raised outlook for the year as well. That snapshot we gave you earlier of Eastman Kodak's troubles, well, that helps explain why shares fell more than 6%. The company reported a widening third quarter loss. Kellogg fell a soggy 7% today. Prices for 10-year T-notes fell. The yield rose to 2.07%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Department of Labor releases the employment report for October. Google Chairman Eric Schmidt is expected to report to Capitol Hill for yet another hearing on company competition and business practices. And Daily Deal website Groupon will officially become a public company. I'm Desiree Pena.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Occupy fill-in-the-blank-yourself here movement has spread to more than 500 places across the country, mostly in the shape of sit-ins and marches and rallies, and mostly peaceful, too. Though there was more violence in Oakland last night, and 16 demonstrators were arrested in New York today on their way to Goldman Sachs. Much has been made of the fact that Occupy doesn't necessarily have a unified set of goals. Commentator Robert Reich says, so what?
Whatever happens to it, the Occupy Wall Street movement has already changed the tune of the public debate. For the first time in more than half a century, a broad cross-section of the American public is talking about the concentration of income, wealth, and political power at the top. Last week's Congressional Budget Office report on widening disparities of income in America was hardly news. It was already well known that the top 1% now gets 20% of the nation's income. That's up from 9% in the late 1970s. But it's the first time such news made the front pages of the nation's major newspapers. And look at public opinion. A recent New York Times CBS News poll found that an astounding 66% of Americans say the nation's wealth should be more evenly distributed. A similar majority believes the rich should pay more in taxes. According to a Wall Street Journal NBC News poll, more than half of people describe themselves as Republicans believe taxes should be increased on the rich. The old view was anyone could make it in America with enough guts and gumption. Being rich was proof of hard work, and lack of money proof of indolence or worse. But hard work doesn't seem to pay off as it once did. Instead, to increasing numbers of Americans, the game seems rigged in favor of people who are already rich and powerful. Nor does wealth trickle down in the form of more jobs and better wages. CEOs are hauling in more than 300 times the pay of average workers. That's up from 40 times average pay only three decades ago. What's worse is that workers are losing their jobs, wages, and benefits. The economy is in trouble because the American middle class no longer has the purchasing power to keep it going. That 2.5% annualized growth rate for the third quarter hides a crucial fact. Americans spent more, largely on health care and utilities, by dipping into their savings, and this isn't sustainable. The Occupy movement is gaining ground because it's hitting a responsive chord. What happens from here on depends on whether other Americans begin to organize and march to the music.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Send us your comments. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Letters This Week begins where a lot of the news has begun, Greece, Europe, and the debts thereof. At the moment, as I said, the Eurozone is still intact. Greece hasn't actually defaulted. But my interview the other day about Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou calling a referendum on the bailout rubbed Dwayne Voth from Austin, Texas, the wrong way. No matter what the markets think, Mr. Voth says, and they didn't think much of the referendum idea, if you remember, Papandreou got it right.
Giving a choice, even if both choices are bad, allows people a chance to think over and buy into a decision. People fight when they're given no choice. Papandreou is doing the humane thing. He's reducing the violence in the streets.
There was that crazy storm in the Northeast this past weekend, followed by more than the usual number of power outages. Tom Stokes of Chandler, Arizona, heard our story and maintains there has to be a better way.
Isn't it time we take power distribution lines from above our heads where they pose obvious safety and reliability problems and put them underground? Couldn't this be one of those economy-boosting infrastructure projects? My wife and I lived in Holland for 4 years, where most power lines are underground. We never had a power interruption despite many snowstorms and a record-setting windstorm.
Send us your thoughts and observations. Probably have to use electricity to do it, though. The website is marketplace.org. There was an Arab League meeting yesterday in Cairo, at which the Syrian government agreed to pull the army out of key cities in that country. The pledge has apparently lasted less than 24 hours. There are reports at least 12 people have been killed in the city of Homs today. Syria is in its seventh month of increasingly violent unrest, and through it all, the business elite has remained mostly loyal to the government. But Reese Ehrlich reports now from Damascus that small businesses are stuck.
Yeah, just walking to my office.
Rana Issa walks into the office of her once successful marketing and advertising business in Damascus. She proudly plays a nationwide radio spot her company produced for Construction Week magazine just last summer.
Construction Week, الآن في سوريا, member of مؤسسة رانا إيسا التجارية.
But after 7 months of protests in Syria and newly imposed international sanctions, the construction industry here is grinding to a halt. That impacts medium-sized businesses as well. Issa recently laid off 25% of her staff, but she blames the pro-democracy protesters, not the government of President Bashar al-Assad.
I love Syria. I love the president. I love everything he do. He give us a lot of promises and he achieve a lot of targets he talking about before. The oppositions, they didn't give him time to work on this.
Most of Syria's business community does not support the pro-democracy movement, according to Nabil Sukar, a former World Bank economist who now heads an economic consulting firm here in Damascus. He says elite businessmen enjoy great wealth under Syria's system of crony capitalism, where friendship and political connections play a great part. Sukar says these business people are, above all, pragmatic.
They expect that the unrest will come to an end sooner or later. They feel the regime is well entrenched. The army is definitely supportive to the regime. It is not likely to split like we have seen in Libya, so that's not expected at all.
But if big business remains loyal to Assad, small business appears politically divided. Here in Damascus's main souk or marketplace, business is slow, very slow. The once booming tourism industry has collapsed. This clothing store owner hasn't seen a single foreign customer in 3 months. The man, who asked that his name not be used, was once a strong supporter of President Assad. Not anymore.
The government made many mistakes. It should have put on trial the police who beat the young people. It should have put the corrupt officials on trial. Young people weren't originally calling for the downfall of the government, but now they are. They are fighting for their rights.
Economist Nabil Sukar says that, at least for now, such sentiments are in the minority among business people. But he says if the political mood shifts, that could spell the end of the Assad government.
Of course, if there is any strikes or serious opposition on the part of the business community, they could paralyze the economy. Any major boycott or opposition on the part of business will paralyze any economy. And if that is going to happen here, it will certainly be disastrous. But frankly, I don't see that happening.
Whatever economists and business leaders say about the government's stability, the determining factor may ultimately be sentiment on the Syrian street. In Damascus, Omri Serlik for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which Occupy Oakland contributes to the local economy, there's a little dive bar in downtown Oakland, right by where all the occupiers are, a place called the Radio Bar. We gave Jeeva Kurchansky a call today. He manages and tends bar there. Wanted to see if the huge demonstrations yesterday did business any harm. Turns out, no.
It was pretty much packed out the door from the minute we opened till 2 a.m. And I did so much business that I literally ran out of every single beer in the place. That's pretty epic, to say the least.
To say the least. Tip was epic, too. A couple of $100, he told us. All right, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Thursday. Today, the Dow climbed 208 points, 1.75%. The NASDAQ up 57 points, 2.2%. The S&P 500 advanced 23 points, 1.8% today in New York. Wait till Greece tomorrow, though, just because you never know. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back on The Big Show, man, those big banks, they can't get any love.
Even after I heard that they were rescinding the fee, I was like, you know, it's just too little too late.
I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.